All right. Time for the third chapter in the evolution unit. This one obviously has to do with evolution again, but this one is called Evolution of Populations, which I'll give another name to in a minute. First, though, let's talk a little bit about this opening slide, which if you look at this in the book where you see a caption under it, the caption is this finch evolving? And so what would you say to that as an answer? Yes, you would say? The vast majority don't care at all one way or the other? Well, it actually depends on what you mean by finch. The important point is this particular bird is not evolving. No individuals evolve. That's not to say that, you know, evolve means change. It's not to say that we don't change. Obviously, we change in our lifetimes. We grow, we develop, but that's not evolution. Evolution is something that occurs between generations, requiring reproduction. And so individuals do not evolve. Populations evolve. And therefore, if you take the word finch to mean this species of finch, yes, the answer could be yes. But this individual bird, no, it is not evolving. No individual evolves. So it's important, since I just used the word population, to remind ourselves of what that is. I defined it last week. What is a population? Keeping in mind that I said this last week. Now, is the silence because you are making the mistake of putting off listening to the lectures until the night before the test, which is exactly the wrong way of doing things? Or did you just genuinely forget?
It's not a group of cells in a specific area?
Not a group of cells. Well, it could be if we're talking about unicellular species. But a population is a group of individuals, more than that, though, right? It's not just a group of individuals. For instance, I and an ant and an elm tree are a group of individuals, but we don't collectively make up a population. So what do you have to say beyond a group of individuals for it to be a population?
They grow in a certain environment.
Yeah, well, it's a group of individuals in a certain area, basically. But beyond that, they are members of the same species. So a population is a group of individuals of the same species in some defined area where they occur. And also, it goes beyond that, they have to be reproducing as well. Okay, yeah. I'm talking about I don't mean every individual has to be reproducing. I'm saying the population, there has to be reproduction in the population. And that's because there's no evolution without reproduction, like I was saying before, which is why evolution only occurs between populations. I mean between generations within a population. So a population can evolve, but that brings up the question of what actually is evolution defined as. Well, remember last week for the lab part, we did Hardy-Weinberg simulation, right? We worked with Hardy-Weinberg model, and at the time I think I told you that that mathematical model can be used to determine whether for a specific characteristic of interest or a specific gene of interest a population is evolving. Remember I said that? Well, That's a yes or no answer of whether it's evolving or not. And the model allows you to test that, to answer the question, yes, it is evolving, no, it isn't evolving. But what is the actual definition? Well, at the population level, which is what we're studying evolution at right now, evolution is defined as a change in allele frequencies over time, over generations, from one generation to the next. And remember, Hardy Weinberg is concerned with allele frequencies, right? What is an allele frequency? It's going to be a long lecture if these are long pauses. What's an allele frequency? What was the first part? Kind of how often, but it's a fraction, right? A frequency is a fraction corresponding to a percentage. Remember, those answers you gave me last week in lab were all frequencies. Well, an allele frequency is simply what fraction of the total number of alleles in the population is a specific type. That's why you had an allele frequency for the dominant allele and an allele frequency for the recessive allele, right? And those frequencies are values. They have a specific value in it for any given generation, right? P equals such and such, and Q equals 1 minus P. They have a specific value. Well, evolution is a change in those allele frequencies. Therefore, whatever P equals in one generation, if it equals something else in the next generation, by definition, evolution has occurred. All right? And also, you should, by that definition, notice that it doesn't make sense to talk about evolution for an individual, right? Because you don't have allele frequencies in your body and they don't change, right? The allele frequency is for the entire population, for that whole allele pool. Okay. So I didn't get into last week about describing how you would determine with Hardy Weinberg whether evolution is occurring for that one gene you care about, but it simply is a matter of looking at P values from one generation to the next, or Q values. If they stay the same, then for that characteristic, the population is not evolving. If they differ, then it is. Okay. In slide 2, we can see a graph that is related to the photograph you just looked in the previous slide. That finch species, that finch that was photographed is a member of a species we're looking at data for in this graph on slide 2. And first of all, notice that we're only talking about 2 years, which is two generations. And in fact, even just one generation, the definition I just gave you for evolution, notice that can happen in one generation. So you might be used to thinking about evolution as occurring over millions or billions of years, and it does certainly. That's extensive evolution. But evolution can happen in a single generation as long as there is a change in the allele frequencies. Well, this is just real data showing evolution in this population that includes the finch pictured in the previous slide. These birds are seed crackers, which is why they have such stout bills. It requires a stout bill to crack the seeds in order to stay alive. And in 1976, the measurement of the average beak depth, the beak depth is how broad it is at where it meets the face, so how tall it is in the picture, was about the same for, as you see, 3 years, a little shy of 9 millimeters. And then a drought hit where they live. Pretty extensive drought. And without water, there wasn't production of new seeds by the trees that make the fruit. I mean, there's some produced, but not nearly as much. And so the birds, in order to live, had to find older seeds from previous years that weren't eaten already, which tend to be harder seeds, tougher to crack, in other words, than new, more tender seeds. And notice what happened. Just within two generations, there was a measurable increase in their bill depth for the population. Now, notice that each individual bird has a given measurement, so there's still variation before and after. But after the drought, it became more advantageous to have a bigger bill because you needed it for tougher seeds. And therefore, just the individuals that happened randomly, genetically, to have that trait were the ones that were favored, that were selected for. So they were the ones that survived and passed on that genetic trait of having a bigger bill to the next generation. So in this next generation, the p-value changed because a greater fraction of the overall allele pool was for the version of the allele that corresponded to a broader bill. Does that make sense? It had evolved, in other words. So this is evolution at the population level, which is all we're going to talk about in this chapter. Another name for that, though, evolution at the population level, is microevolution, as opposed, you probably guessed, to macroevolution. But we'll talk about macroevolution in a different chapter. First, let's go to 3 and look at these horses. As in any real population, whatever the species is, we talked about this on the first week, there is phenotypic variation from individual to individual within the population. First of all, what do I mean by phenotypic? What is that another name for? What is a phenotype?
Trait.
Yeah, it's another name for trait, basically. Genotype is the specific DNA version you have. That's a symbol is used for that, right? The A's and the B's or whatever. Phenotype is what the actual trait is in words. So we use phrases like blue-eyed or green-eyed or whatever. So there's all kinds of different characteristics, right? Each of which has traits associated with it. But one that's obvious to us when we look at a picture is coloration. And just ignoring all other characteristics, if all you pay attention to here is coat coloration, the color of the fur, we notice that not all these members of this one population are equal, right? They have different traits for that one characteristic. There is phenotypic variation. By the way, well, I'll get into that in a little bit. But in this case, this phenotypic variation is not like what we've talked about up to now, the Mendelian case, where there is either one trait or another, right? Which was all of what your problems were about. It was just two possibilities, right? Two alleles for each characteristic, and therefore two traits per characteristic or two alleles per gene. Here, though, we have a characteristic with many different possible traits. This is an example of a characteristic that has its traits occur on a continuum, a continuous range from two extremes. And very similar to human skin color, right? There's not just two human skin colors. There's all kinds of different human skin colors that vary somewhere between very light and very dark. Same with these horses. There's very light ones, very dark ones, not just one color or another. And you see this, is usually an indication of what we call polygenic inheritance. Now, what does the word polygenic mean? Multiple genes involved, exactly. So we've been talking so far in the normal and simple Mendelian case, like we've been talking about, one gene corresponding to a characteristic, right? There's a eye color gene, for instance, or a dragon wing gene, like you were talking about in the picture. Well, sometimes that's how things work, but not always. In fact, often it works differently. Sometimes for a single characteristic, like coat color in these horses, multiple different genes are involved, and they each contribute some to the overall phenotype. And this is why you can have so many different traits for the same characteristic. Same way with human skin color. There's not a single human skin color gene. There are multiple genes that each contribute. And so you have a variation in traits along a continuum from one extreme to another. Now, as far as evolution is concerned, it's important to note that the variation within the population has to be heritable variation in order for it to work, in order for it to evolve. Evolution only deals with heritable variation, because heritable variation means variation that gets inherited, gets passed on to the next generation via reproduction, right? If it's not heritable variation, if it's something that happens to you during your lifetime, but it's not defined by your genes, like a person, you know, become a bodybuilder, like I used as an example before, that's not going to get passed on, right? That's not heritable variation. So evolution operates only on heritable variation, which is only some of the variation that we see in real populations. Four. Now, the blue strip that we see here represents a stretch of DNA. And it's a long stretch of DNA. We're not seeing the whole thing. It's all one piece. It's just shown in two sections. But anyway, it represents a piece of a chromosome. A single chromosome is an enormously long double-stranded DNA the sequence of which, the very long sequence of which, is really contains shorter subsequences within it that we call genes, right? That's what a gene is. Physically, a gene is just a stretch of DNA, but it's only part of the overall stretch that we call a chromosome. It's still a sequence of DNA nucleotides, though. All right? And DNA is the thing, materially, that actually gets passed on from parent to offspring. Whether it's a sexual or an asexual species, all species pass on their DNA to their offspring. And that is what physically gets inherited. It's not, you know, brown hairedness that gets passed on. It's the DNA that indirectly codes for brown hair that gets passed on, right? That's what molecularly gets sent to the offspring. And therefore, that's what evolution by natural selection operates on. Okay? Well, I've mentioned a couple times that despite the enormous variety of organisms that we have in the tree of life, all those organisms that have ever existed, now or before, all descended from an original successful lineage of cells, right? Which is at the trunk of the overall tree of life. We're all descendants from those original cells. But clearly, the major reason why there is such diversity in life is because different species have different DNA, right? Even different individuals within a species have different DNA, but clearly different species have even more different DNA. That's not news to you, I'm sure. But this brings up the fundamental question of how is it that species have different DNA? What is the original source of all genetic variation? You know, a cell, when it successfully undergoes cell division to produce two new cells, in order for it to do that, in order for those two daughter cells to live, they each have to have a full DNA library, right? So a cell that's about to divide first has to copy its own library, so there are two identical copies, one for each of the two daughter cells. It can't just give one cell half the library and the other cell half the library. They're going to be missing genes that are necessary for life. So if there's perfect copying of DNA and we're all descendants of the original cell, why are we not just all genetic copies of that original organism? Why is it that there are different versions of DNA? What's the source? Mutation. Mutation, which is accidental, changes in DNA sequence. And by accidental, I mean that it just happens for one reason or another, accidentally. It doesn't happen in a certain direction toward better fitness or toward worse fitness. It's just a random change in nucleotide sequence. Because the copying mechanism, as good as it is, sometimes doesn't make a perfect copy. All right? That's mutation. And if it weren't for mutation, then we would all just be genetically identical cells that are just like that original cell. We're not, because mutation has occurred along the way. And in this slide, we see mutations represented by the orange marks on the DNA. So every one of these orange marks represents a mutation that has occurred somewhere in this sequence of DNA. Now, every mutation results in a change in the DNA sequence by definition. But that doesn't actually necessarily mean that there's going to be a corresponding change in phenotype. Earlier, I asked you, what is it? I think I asked you this question, I usually do. What is it that gives an organism its traits directly? What is that? Proteins, right. We like to say that DNA gives organisms their traits. That's only true indirectly. Proteins directly determine the traits. But proteins, even though there's effectively an infinite number of possible proteins that could be produced, no cell knows how to make a protein from scratch. They have to be told to by being given a set of instructions. In other words, you have to use this amino acid first, then hook this amino acid on, and then this one for a certain number of amino acids. Then you have the polypeptide, which is the protein, right? Well, that's where DNA comes in. DNA, by having a certain nucleotide sequence, stores the code for indirectly how to build a protein. It's an indirect process because there's two processes you should have learned about in 181 that deals with this. Protein synthesis, making the actual protein, involves two steps starting with DNA. What are those two major steps? Think back to 181. Yeah, the creation of a protein involves two major steps, starting with involvement of DNA. What is that first step called? No, mitosis is important for cell division. That's how we get new cells. It's division of the nucleus. But I'm talking about within the lifetime of a cell. So one of your kidney cells is busy being a kidney cell. And it's being a kidney cell because it's making specific proteins that are required in being a kidney cell. Well, it can't do that, like I said, from scratch. It has to be told how to do that. That starts with a gene, right? A specific gene. But what is the process that involves reading that gene, the first part of producing the protein. Transcription, right. And every gene that's transcribed directly results in the production of what? What does transcription produce? RNA. So DNA's job is over. It was holding a code. Now the code has been put into an RNA molecule, right? And then that leads to the second step after transcription, which is what? Translation. That's when a ribosome now reads the code that's in a messenger RNA molecule that was produced in transcription, and it uses that code for how to assemble the polypeptide making the protein. And that protein is what actually determines the trait. So different alleles, different versions of genes, right, for the same gene, those result in different RNAs being produced, which result in different sequences of amino acids, therefore different versions of the protein, corresponding to the different traits of that same characteristic. Is that all clear? All right. Well, what I was saying a little bit ago is that mutations occur randomly within the genome. The genome simply refers to the entirety of the DNA in an organism. And what I said is that just because a mutation occurs does not necessarily mean that it's going to change a phenotype. In order for a phenotype to change, that means you're going to have to change the protein at least a little bit, if not drastically. And not all mutations lead to changes in protein for several different reasons. Okay, one reason. Well, let me start it with a question. Do you have any idea roughly how many genes are in the human genome? Just an estimate. How many genes do humans have? It ended up being a major surprise. We found out finally after 10 years we completed the Human Genome Project by sequencing human DNA, and it ended up being far fewer than we expected. It's only about 20,000 genes. For reasons that I'm not going to get into, because that's more of a 181 thing, we actually can make more than 20,000 proteins. Can make more proteins than there are genes, but about 20,000. Other species have more, other species have few, but for humans it's about 20,000. Anyway, you might be surprised also, if you were surprised by that, that these genes, these 20,000 genes, if you combine all of those sequences, each gene is a sequence, right? You combine all 20,000 of those, that's only about 1% of your overall DNA. Between each gene is a stretch of nucleotides also, only it's not a gene because it doesn't code for RNA. Right? So there are these long intervening sequences of DNA that we're still learning about, but that are not transcribed. They're non-coding regions of DNA. And that's actually the vast majority of your DNA. So one reason why a mutation can have no effect, in fact, it's probable that it will have no effect, is because a mutation is random. It can occur anywhere in the chromosome, and there's a 99% chance that's going to hit one of these regions between genes, not inside a gene. And therefore, that has a pretty good chance of not affecting gene expression at all. Okay? So, every once in a while, though, just purely randomly, like all mutations are, the mutation will actually happen within a gene. And we're looking at a gene here. This is not nearly the entire chromosome sequence. This is just one gene's worth, along with thousands of other genes on that same chromosome, and a hell of a lot of space in between them. So even if a mutation is, so, in a sense, lucky enough to occur within a gene, that's still no guarantee that it's going to affect the phenotype. Once again, for multiple reasons. One of these has to do with something that you hopefully learned in 181 about the difference between prokaryotic mRNA and eukaryotic mRNA. In prokaryotes, bacteria and archaea, the messenger RNA that gets produced by transcription is ready to go as soon as it's produced. It doesn't have to be modified post-transcriptionally. It can immediately go on to being translated. But in eukaryotes, which of course we're members of, the mRNA that gets spit out of the transcription assembly line is not ready to go into translation. And there we therefore call it pre-mRNA. It needs to be modified after transcription. You might remember the poly-A tail and the 5' cap that get put onto the mRNA that allows it to get out of the nucleus through the nuclear pores. That's one, that's part of post-transcriptional modification. But another thing, another part of that modification that occurs only in eukaryotes is that the pre-mRNA, which is a sequence, right, of nucleotides, includes regions that are called exons and regions that are called introns, denoted here by dark and light blue. Do you remember studying introns and exons? Do you at least remember the words? Exons get their name because they end up actually being expressed. That's what the X part means. Introns get their names because they are intervening sequences between the exons that don't actually get expressed. Instead, they get cut out as part of this post-transcriptional modification. Spliceosomes, do you remember spliceosomes from 181? Spliceosomes are huge molecular complexes that read the pre-mRNA and see where the introns are and snip them out and then sew the exons together to make the final version of messenger RNA, which can then go on to translation. So, here we have DNA. Introns and exons really are part of the messenger RNA, not the DNA. But there are corresponding regions in the DNA, right? Because it's a one-to-one correspondence between DNA and messenger RNA. So we can talk about introns and exons in the DNA as well. And the next reason why a mutation, even if it occurs within a gene, might not make any difference is that there's a good chance it will occur in one of these intron regions. So yes, it's a different version of DNA, and it will even maybe change the version of mRNA. I mean, it will change the mRNA sequence as well, the pre-mRNA. But the introns get cut out of the pre-mRNA anyway. So even though they're different, they don't make the final cut. And therefore, they don't affect the final protein product once translation occurs. Is that all clear? All right, so the next even less likely possibility is that a mutation occurs not only within a gene, but within an exon, which corresponds to the part of the pre-mRNA that's going to still be there, right? Well, if you have a mutation there, you have a different nucleotide sequence in the DNA, and therefore, you know, the cell doesn't know that it's different now. It just obeys the transcription rules, and it will change the messenger RNA value for the exon that corresponds to that mutation. Right? That's a new version of messenger RNA. But even that might still not affect the trait. And that's because of something about how translation works. More 181 material, but hopefully you'll remember this. Transcription is a one-to-one relationship. It's called transcription, which simply means rewriting, right? Because you're staying within the language of nucleotides. You're going from DNA nucleotides to RNA nucleotides. But there's four kinds of DNA nucleotides and there's four kinds of RNA nucleotides, right? So it's a one-to-one correspondence. Every DNA nucleotide individually is read and to determine which of the four RNA nucleotides get put into the RNA. All right? In other words, one DNA nucleotide stands for one RNA nucleotide in transcription. But in translation, it can't be that simple. In other words, you can't have one RNA nucleotide stand for one amino acid. That would be the simplest case. That would be the preferred case because of the simplicity. But why is it that you can't have one messenger RNA nucleotide stand for one amino acid? What's the problem with that?
Can you repeat that question?
Yeah, why is it that translation can't have one RNA nucleotide stand for or represent one amino acid? Any ideas? Well, how many RNA nucleotides are there? I don't mean how many are in the sequence. I mean how many kinds of RNA nucleotides are there that are normally used? You remember this at all? Well, how many DNA nucleotide types are there? What do you use to represent a sequence of DNA? All the letters? All 26 letters?
Four.
Right. C's, T's, A's, and G's, right? There's four kinds of DNA nucleotides. How many kinds of RNA nucleotides are there? Four. That's why it's a one-to-one relationship in transcription. A single DNA nucleotide can represent a single RNA nucleotide. Okay, so you have four RNA nucleotide types. What are the monomers from which proteins are built? A polypeptide is a polymer of what subunits? What are the subunits of a protein, in other words? Amino acids. How many types of amino acids do organisms use?
13.
20. And 20 is not equal to 4, right? So you see the problem? Why you can't have one RNA nucleotide represent one amino acid? You only have four types of RNA nucleotides to work with, right? So you could only represent four of the necessary 20 amino acids. Therefore, there is not a one-to-one correspondence in translation. The next simplest case is to have a sequence of two RNA nucleotides represent a single amino acid, right? But if you have a sequence of two and each digit, there's four possibilities. How many overall possibilities are there? It's like rolling a four-sided die twice. How many possibilities? Four times four, right? There's four possibilities for the first digit, and for each of those four, there's four for the second digit. So there's four times four possibilities. 16, though, is still less than 20. You need to have 20 different sequences if you're going to specify all 20 amino acids. So the simplest possibility that will work is to have a sequence of three RNA nucleotides represent one amino acid. What do we call that sequence of three mRNA nucleotides? A codon. And each codon specifies a particular amino acid. But how many possibilities are there for a sequence of three nucleotides, each of which there are four kinds? 64. 3 times 4 times 4 times 4. Right? 64. And 64 is more than you need. You only need 20. So that's why when you look at the genetic code, which is the universal genetic code that all organisms use because we all evolved from the same ancestor, you see all 64 codons listed. 64 is more than 20, so that means you have the ability to use more than one codon to specify the same amino acid. We call that redundancy. The genetic code is redundant, but it is not ambiguous. Ambiguous means being unclear because there's multiple meanings, right? Well, you wouldn't want that in the genetic code. Every time you're reading a codon, that needs to mean that same amino acid every time it's read. So it's not ambiguous, but it's redundant simply because you have more than 20 to work with. And redundancy is kind of like having synonyms in language, right? There's a lot of different ways you can say good or big without those two words, right? Gigantic, enormous, there are all kinds of synonyms for big. And similarly, you can have more than one codon specifying the same amino acid. Okay, the reason, even though that was 181 material, the reason I went through that again is because it's possible for a mutation to not only occur in a gene and not only occur within an exon, but still have no effect. Because even though it will change the codon in the DNA and therefore change the codon in the mRNA, if it happens to be a change so that you're changing one codon into a different codon that still specifies the same amino acid because of redundancy, then you're still going to put the right amino acid in the protein anyway. You're just using a different codon to specify it. And therefore, the thing that matters for the phenotype, which is the protein, is exactly the same as if the mutation had never occurred. That's called a silent mutation. Okay? So, mutations are pretty rare to begin with. The majority of those occur between genes. A small fraction of the ones that do hit genes occur within introns and therefore do not affect the phenotype. And some of the ones that get even into the exons still have no effect because of the redundancy of the genetic code. And even the ones that actually do result in a different protein being produced, it is possible that a single amino acid being different in the overall protein, even though it will be a different protein, it might be pretty neutral with respect to how the protein operates. But it's also possible that just a single amino acid being changed by a single mutation will result in a drastically different protein, one that either kills the organism that has it or gives it the other extreme, a benefit. That's how we get proteins that actually do a better job, and those are the ones that get favored by natural selection, and that's why over time populations become better and better adapted to their conditions, because only the best alleles get selected for, the ones that work. But none of that would occur if you didn't have mutation causing new versions of DNA to begin with. Okay? Let's go to 5 now. This one won't take as long. Here you're looking at two different caterpillars, which you kind of have to be told they're caterpillars. If you're just glancing at these, you would think you're just looking at plant parts. Because these are such convincing examples of camouflage, right? This one looks very much like the fruit that's beside it. This one looks very much like the tree branch. And only if you really are looking, if I tell you there's caterpillars there, you'll notice it. But if you're trying to find caterpillars to eat, you might go right by these if you're a predator, right? They're well hidden. Well, this brings up something I said before. You might think these drastically differently appearing caterpillars, because they are so drastically different, must have quite different DNA. But actually, they don't have different DNA at all. They're The reason that they are so drastically different in phenotype is because of environment. They have the same DNA, but this one grew up eating the oak flowers, and it therefore took on the appearance of the oak flowers because of its diet. This one instead ate the leaves, and it ends up looking like the stems. And the point here that I brought up earlier is that not all phenotypic variation is genetic and is heritable, right? There is an environmental component to variation as well. And this is what's behind the popular phrase, nature versus nurture. Nature refers to the DNA that you're stuck with, that you got from your parents. That, of course, has an effect on your phenotype, right? But also, the nurture part refers to how you live your life, what you're exposed to in your environment. There's an environmental component to variation as well, which is why you can separate identical twins at birth, right? Let them go to different parts of the world for 80 years and live separate lives. Get them back together, they're not going to look identical still, even though they still have the same DNA other than mutations that occurred in their body. Important, and this is an extreme example of environmental influence, but the point here is that environmental components of phenotypic variation cannot be operated on by natural selection. Only heritable variation can be selected for or against by natural selection. Does that make sense? Okay. Then let's go to 6. On the map here, we see shaded regions, pink and blue shaded regions, that represent what are called ranges for populations. Any given population, remember I said, occurs in a specific area. That specific area is the population's range. And remember, I also said that a population is a group of individuals of the same species. So a single species can actually have multiple populations. They're all the same species, but they're distinct populations. Well, that is easy to understand if they never come into contact with each other, why they would be separate populations. But you can actually have separate populations that encounter each other, that overlap geographically, like you see here. And so you might be saying, well, why not just say this is all one big population? Well, that's because of what I kind of lightly mentioned before when we were talking about the definition of population. I remember I said that another component of the population definition is that they have to be reproducing as a population. So if they're choosing not to, for instance, if they choose only to, in this case of these mammals, mate with other ones of their same population, even though they come into contact with the other population that they could mate with, then they are by definition separate populations. All right. Let's go to 7. Well, I can breeze through these couple slides because we've already talked about this. Slides 7 and 8 at least, maybe 9, have to do with Hardy-Weinberg. And so we've already discussed this. I just want to remind you you tell me, what is the first of the two Hardy-Weinberg equations in the model? P plus Q equals 1. And what is that first equation always used for? Only used for? Allele frequencies, correct. Not individuals. Allele frequencies in the overall allele pool. What does P always represent? The allele frequency for the dominant allele in the population. And Q is the frequency of the recessive allele. And remember, even though there can be more than two alleles, the Hardy-Weinberg model doesn't work. It would have to be more complicated math for those situations. But in some situations, for certain genes, there are just two alleles, right? Like all the things Mendel did were just two alleles for each characteristic for each gene. And there, that's why P plus Q have to add up to 1, because if those are the only two types of alleles, their frequencies have to add up to the total, which is 1, right? What is the second equation in the model? P squared plus 2PQ plus Q squared equals 1. And what is that equation used for? Frequencies of individuals, diploid individuals, right? And there are three terms in that, not two like in the first one, right? The three terms are P squared, 2PQ, and Q squared. What does P squared always mean? The frequency of the homozygous dominant individuals in the population. Q squared is the frequency of homozygous recessive individuals in the population. And 2PQ is the frequency of heterozygous individuals in the population. Why is it not just PQ, but 2PQ instead? Why? Anyone else? A heterozygous is P and Q are both involved in a heterozygous individual, right? Because you have to have a dominant allele and a recessive allele. There's a P chance of getting a dominant allele and a Q chance of getting a recessive allele. So it makes sense that P and Q are multiplied together. But why 2PQ? It's because there's two ways that you can become heterozygous, right? There's only one way to be homozygous. You get a homozygous dominant. You get a dominant from your mother, you get a dominant from your father. Similarly, there's only one way to become homozygous recessive. But there's two ways to become heterozygous, right? Get your dominant from your father and your recessive from your mother, or get your dominant from your mother and your recessive from your father. So it's P squared, PQ times 2, 2PQ. All right, well, this just illustrates this using a specific example, 0.8 and 0.2. The point I was making earlier about the definition of evolution and using the model to determine whether or not for that characteristic being studied, whether or not the population is evolving, it really just boils down to actually measuring these values. P is 0.8 and Q is 0.2. If in the next generation P is still 0.8 and Q is still 0.2, then it has not evolved. By definition. When it hasn't evolved, we say it is in Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium. But if those values change, then it has evolved for that characteristic. Now, any real population is going to be evolving if you were to consider all the various characteristics. But remember, we can't study everything at once. So it's possible for a population not to be evolving if all you care about is one isolated characteristic, even though other characteristics are evolving. Slide 8 is also Hardy-Weinberg involved, but this just shows you mathematically how P squared works, Q squared works, and 2PQ works. Okay, that brings us to 9. Now, I've already talked about natural selection, and hopefully you have a good feel for what that means. Remember that Darwin is famous for natural selection, not for evolution. And natural selection is the explanation for how evolution occurs, right? That's what he's famous for scientifically explaining how it works, not just that evolution occurs. But as it turns out, natural selection, although it is one way in which evolution occurs, it's not the only way in which evolution can occur. There are three major mechanisms that lead to evolution, that cause evolution. And one of them, of course, is natural selection. The other two, though, I haven't talked about yet. Those other two are genetic drift, and the third is gene flow. Now, be careful with those phrases because they kind of sound similar. Drift and flow in everyday language kind of conjure up similar pictures, right? But they mean distinct things, obviously, in biology, in genetics. Well, let's start with genetic drift because that's what's pictured in slide 9. Genetic drift is a random occurrence in which something, some event, which is itself random, like a storm, for instance, something happening in the environment, causes the elimination of some alleles from the allele pool. Now, in a lot of cases, like us, alleles are carried in individuals, right? There's not really an allele pool in the center of town. The alleles are carried by individuals. But when an individual gets killed or dies for some reason, its alleles are eliminated from that allele pool, right? And that's what genetic drift is. It's not just the loss of those alleles, because that also happens in natural selection, right? Some organisms don't make it. But in natural selection, those alleles are lost because those individuals have maladaptive traits. And that's why they're selected against. In genetic drift, it has nothing to do whether the organisms that have these alleles are well adapted or not. They just simply randomly get eliminated. Okay? To illustrate that, we have a simple example using a population of plants, flowering plants. Notice that there are three traits. Even though this is one gene, there's three traits: pink flowered, white flowered, and red flowered. By the way, the reason there's three is because it's not complete dominance. It's an example of incomplete dominance. The only way you're red flowered is if you're homozygous dominant. If you're heterozygous, you're only partially red and therefore pink. And if you're homozygous recessive, you're white. Other than that, it's the same as things we've studied before. But anyway, that's the population we have. And so there is genetic variation, phenotypic variation that is caused by genes. And for whatever reason, you know, red flowers might be worse or better than white. It depends on what the conditions they're living in are, right? The point about genetic drift is that it has nothing to do with their fitness. So it could be that some lumbering ox comes walking along looking for food and just randomly steps on a bunch of these plants, killing them, having nothing to do with whether they're well adapted, right? Just some get eliminated, and therefore those alleles get removed from the population. That's genetic drift. And the reason that genetic drift leads to evolution is because of the definition of evolution that I gave you, right? Evolution is a change in allele frequencies. Well, if you eliminate some alleles from the allele pool, you're going to change those frequencies, right? By definition, mathematically. So, evolution is caused by genetic drift, but since it's random and has nothing to do with fitness, there's just as good a chance that the ones that are eliminated are maladaptive as there is a chance that they are actually better fit, and you're eliminating them even though they're more well adapted. What that means is that genetic drift, even though it causes evolution, does not reliably lead to better and better adaptation by the population over generations. It might make the next generation slightly better, but then if it happens again in the next generation, it might go in the other way and make them even less adapted, because the event, the random event, has nothing to do with their fitness. You see the difference between that and natural selection? Okay, then let's see some specific subcategories of genetic drift. The first example, I actually don't have a picture for, so call this slide 9.5. Just listen to me instead of having a picture. One way that you can have genetic drift is by something we call the founder effect. Founder meaning the founders of a population, the ones that start a population. This is genetic drift because something random happens and eliminates some individuals, right? But if it's the founder effect, what happens is that it's a pretty drastic random event that leaves only a small number of individuals from the original population. Now, it's not necessary that the rest of them get killed, actually. I mean, one way you could imagine this happening is if you have a population of bird species, and just a small number of them get blown off course as they're migrating. So they end up going somewhere where they're not supposed to go, and they're separated from the rest of the population, and they are therefore now the founders of a new population wherever they land. Well, since it didn't have anything to do with how well fit they are, whatever the phenotypes of these individual founders are, that's what the population stuck with, right? Because now they are going to pass those genes on, and the next population is going to be like them, whether it's good or bad. That's the founder effect. In slide 10, we have basically the same thing happening, but it goes by a different name. This is called the bottleneck effect. It's also genetic drift. What happens here is that actually only a small number survive whatever the event is. So it's not that they just get separated like in the founder effect. They actually are the sole survivors. Or I shouldn't say sole survivors, the small number of survivors. And the rest of them get killed by earthquake or whatever it is that's random. And then whatever traits they happen to have randomly, that's what's going to determine the traits of the population from then on. So genetic drift has the problem of reducing genetic variability in the population. And that can be, as we'll study later in other units, dangerous for the population. It can cause extinction if it gets bad enough. But anyway, those are all sub-examples of genetic drift. 11 is actually another example of genetic drift. This is another bottleneck effect. We saw one with a mammal before. Here we have an example using prairie chickens, which used to be very, very abundant in the Midwestern states. You see Illinois here. That's just one state that they're in. The whole region, though, just many, many prairie chickens originally before we started converting the land for other purposes like living in them or using them for agriculture. So we basically just squeeze these populations into smaller and smaller areas. And we basically, because of our activity, we caused a bottleneck effect in these. And what we can see is that by 1993, there were just a tiny couple populations in Illinois. And they were trying their best. They were undergoing the motions. They were mating. And, you know, they were creating fertilized eggs and trying to incubate those eggs. It's just that they would not hatch because by then the genes that were still in the population were just so maladaptive, they just happened to be the only ones left, that these were headed toward extinction quickly. Just shows you the drastic effect of the bottleneck effect. We'll use this as another example in a different chapter. But for now, that's just a bottleneck example. Now in 12, we can talk finally about the third mechanism of evolution, which is gene flow. Gene flow refers to the movement of alleles into or out of a population. So in an ordinary population like we've described it, right, there is an allele pool, and those alleles stay within that population. In gene flow, you're either adding alleles to that gene pool or subtracting them from it. The easiest way to picture this is simply by migration, right? You have a certain population, there's so many individuals in it. Well, if another individual of the same species from a different population comes in, that's gene flow. Now you have a different overall allele pool, right? And by definition, now you've changed the value of P and Q because you've added alleles to that overall pool. So by definition, evolution has occurred. Gene flow causes evolution. whether you're adding or subtracting alleles. But just like genetic drift, this doesn't necessarily have anything to do with fitness, right? And therefore, even though gene flow causes evolution, it doesn't reliably increase the overall fitness or adaptiveness of the population. It can go up or down because of gene flow, just like it can for genetic drift. And therefore, importantly, although there are three mechanisms that lead to evolution that we've just named, the only one of those three that reliably increase adaptation of the population as a whole from generation to generation is natural selection. Because it's selecting the ones that work, the traits that work. Oh, well, anyway, to describe this picture, we're looking here at a... There's really three populations of this bird species involved. One is not shown on the picture, but it's a population that lives on the mainland of the Netherlands. This isn't a map of the Netherlands, it's a map of an island off of the Netherlands, off the coast of the Netherlands. So this is an island much smaller than the mainland. And on this island are two other populations of this same species. All right? Now, one is the central population, one of them the eastern population. And if you look at the graph, you can see that the central population is not doing nearly as well in terms of survival rate as the eastern population. In other words, in terms of adaptation, the central population is not nearly as well adapted. Is that clear? So the question is why? If natural selection is operating, you would expect all three populations to get more and more adapted to their particular surroundings. And each of the three environments are different. So there's different sets of selection pressures operating. There's different sets of conditions that are actually beneficial in each of the three populations. But still, natural selection should choose the ones that have those right traits in each of the three populations, right? So you would expect adaptation to go up in all three populations, including the ones shown here on the graph. So why don't they? Well, the answer is because natural selection isn't the only thing happening. It is working, and if it were the only thing working, then you would have increased adaptation in both of these species graphed. But you, in addition to natural selection, you also have gene flow occurring. And gene flow is undoing some of the progress that natural selection is causing. Because gene flow is random, right? It can go up or down in terms of adaptation. So that explains why they're not continuously getting better, but why is it that the central population is more affected by the gene flow than the eastern population? Because the eastern population, the natural selection is outshining the gene flow. In the central population, the gene flow has more of an effect. It's undoing more of the natural selection. Why would that be? Well, if you look at the map, it'd be helpful to see the map of the mainland Netherlands, but it's below here. Then the mainland population is closer to the central population than to the eastern population. And remember what I said gene flow is. It's movement of alleles, and in this case of birds, that means movement of individuals carrying those alleles, right? So you have some birds from the mainland population that are just leaving. And they are going to one of these populations. But the first stop along the way is the central population. So it's more likely that that's where they're going to end up than it is in the farther one. And therefore, the central population is undergoing more gene flow. And though those birds coming in might be well adapted to the mainland, they're not well adapted to the central population conditions. And that has a greater effect. It's less likely that they're going to go to the farther eastern population, so there's less gene flow occurring there. 13. Well, we've just said that of the three mechanisms of evolution, the only one that leads to reliably increased adaptation is natural selection. So now we're going to, for the rest of the chapter, focus on that, including slide 13. What you see here is that if natural selection is operating in a population, then there are three ways that can happen. They're all natural selection, but there's three subcategories of natural selection, which you see listed on the bottom. Directional selection, disruptive selection, and stabilizing selection. One of these three things are going to happen if natural selection is occurring. But it depends on the particular environment and the particular population as to which one is going to occur. Let me just define the difference, though, between them. At the top, you have a graph representing the population before it evolves by natural selection. So you have a nice bell curve, right? And what is the characteristic being studied here?
Fur color.
Fur color in these rodents. And notice this is another example of one that where you probably have phenotypic variation because you have a continuum from light coat to dark coat. And in this before natural selection, in the before shot, medium darkness happens to be the best situation for those particular circumstances that they live in. That's why the bell curve is highest in the middle brown. Okay? You do have some light and some dark, but not as many as the medium. Okay, now selection pressure is applied. Natural selection is occurring. And the selection pressures, which is really the conditions of the environment, those are the selection pressures. Those are represented in these bottom graphs by the white arrows. If it's directional selection that's occurring as natural selection, that means that there is going to be a shift, a phenotypic shift in one direction or the other. Now, it happens to be showing it shifting to the right toward darker, but it would still be directional selection if it shifted toward the lighter being favored. The point is, it's one way or the other. That's why it's directional. And there's many ways, there's many reasons why this would be the case. That doesn't really matter. I mean, it might mean that pollution might be so bad that the backgrounds are darker now, and so it makes it better to hang out, to be better camouflaged, it's better to be darker yourself. Doesn't matter what the reason are, this is directional selection. All right? Next possibility is disruptive selection. And in this case, it's the intermediate phenotype that is disfavored. And therefore, the two extremes are favored. But both, not just one extreme, both extremes. So notice this leads to a lot of lights and a lot of darks and not as many mediums. So this disruptive selection is called disruptive selection because it disrupts the bell curve, which is unimodal, means it has one hump. Now it is bimodal, it has two humps. Yeah, disruptive selection disfavors the intermediate phenotype and increases the frequency of the extreme phenotypes. The only other possibility, if you're talking about natural selection, is stabilizing selection, which really just reinforces the advantage of the intermediate phenotype. You started already having mostly intermediate, right? But if it's stabilizing selection, they're favored even more. So you get an even higher frequency of the intermediate brown and an even lower frequency for light and dark. Therefore, the position of the bell curve still in the middle, but it gets higher and the tails fall off faster on either side.
So that one's favoring the medium?
That's in a sense, that is exactly the opposite of disruptive selection in terms of which phenotypes get favored. All right, 14. Now in 14, we are looking at a pretty extreme example of how drastically different species can become over enough generations if natural selection is what is operating for evolution. You wouldn't see this if it's gene flow or genetic drift, right? Because they will go up or down in terms of adaptation. But this snake is obviously very well adapted to its conditions of living. So much so that it can open its jaw to swallow something that's bigger than its head. That wouldn't happen by either of the other methods of evolution, but by natural selection, it gradually happens. Because each generation, there's a favoring of looser and looser jaws, right? And so over time, it becomes even more and more drastically loose. So this is what I meant earlier when I said that only natural selection reliably over multiple generations leads to greater and greater adaptation. Well, the photograph that we're looking at here of the peacock and the peahen is a good illustration of a special kind of natural selection called sexual selection. Sexual selection is still natural selection, but it gets its own name because it operates a little bit differently, and actually was very confusing to Darwin and others. Because it seems like in sexual selection, well, it doesn't just seem like it, maladaptive traits can be favored in sexual selection. That's not what you'd expect for natural selection, right? If traits are maladaptive for that particular population's style of living, their living conditions, then natural selection, you would expect, would eliminate the individuals that have those maladaptive traits, and over time you would expect those maladaptive traits to be eliminated. But remember, always remember, the importance, the requirement of reproduction for evolution. You can't have evolution without successful reproduction. So just because you happen to have good traits that make you very well fit, that's going to be meaningless if you just die and your alleles die with you. In other words, if you're not given a chance to pass them on because you don't get a chance to mate, then it doesn't matter what your genes are, right? You are going to be an extinct lineage if you die without passing those traits on. So what we have here in this good example is a peacock showing off to the peahen by fanning out this ridiculously gaudy and enormous tail that you would think would be a very bad thing to evolve in a peacock, which is an animal that's trying to avoid being eaten by things that like to eat peacocks, right? Because it's basically almost a neon flashing sign saying, here I am, predators, eat me. Especially when it's fanned out like it is. Yes, the peacock can collapse it, but not up into nothingness. Even when it's collapsed, it's still a huge long thing that it has to then, if it's trying to avoid a predator, drag through the woods behind it, which makes it a slow animal that's likely to get caught up in a tree or something that snags the tail, and it'll still be easy to eat. So you would think that natural selection would disfavor such a tail that doesn't really benefit its survival. In fact, it's worse for its survival, right? The reason, though, that it does get favored is because the female prefers it. And unless she allows a male to mate with her, no alleles get passed on. So it speaks to the requirement of reproduction to evolution, right? And that's why it's called sexual selection, because it's a mate choice that is happening here. Yeah.
Did you say if they didn't mate because of that, would then they start to lose their family as they move on?
Well, if there's a change in what the average preference is for the females, then yes, if they, for whatever genetic reason, started saying, I prefer the ones without tails, there was a lot of these, then yes, you would see an evolution toward smaller and smaller tails. But that would still be sexual selection, because it's based on mate choice. Another example of sexual selection. This one's kind of interesting, involving frogs. Frogs, like any other sexual species, are interested in mating, or they're at least instinctively thinking they're supposed to mate. And like many animal species that mate, there is a vocal call letting females know that the males are present and trying to impress them, just like the peacock's tail, only vocally. Well, this is very similar to the peacock tail, because the louder and more frequently a frog croaks trying to impress a female into picking him, the more and more easy it is to find that male frog and eat him, right? It'd be much better in terms of survival if he just sat there and shut up, because the predators wouldn't find him. But then he would die not passing on his genes, because no female is going to choose him. So they're really doing the vocal equivalent of fanning the peacock tail out. And once again, it's sexual selection. Now, it doesn't really matter. Well, the experiment that's being shown here, that actually took place, is trying to answer the question of whether females are making a mate choice corresponding to better genes in the males that they pick. In other words, you would think overall, even though you have the tensions between survival and mating that we've already talked about, for you'd expect this, since this is natural selection, you would expect that the female choices are actually corresponding to things in the males they choose that are actually better than the ones they don't choose. That would make sense, right? So this experiment is trying to answer that question. Now, of course, the females have no idea what genetics is. They're just making a choice based on their instinct. So it doesn't matter whether they actually are conscious that their choices correspond to better genes in those males. As long as they do correspond, natural selection will still work correctly, right? So they try to just determine whether they were actually choosing correctly in terms of overall fitness. There are two major kinds of males here. One, short callers and long callers. Notice by the sonograms that you see here that short callers don't, you know, they have not as long a call. And females will prefer one over the other if they're given a choice. But experimentally, we don't leave it up to the female anymore. So in this experiment, they took sperm from short callers in one batch and from long callers in the other batch, and they took eggs from the females, and they gave them equal chances, basically, by fertilizing eggs with both types of sperm. One batch was fertilized with long calling sperm, the other with short calling sperm. They gave them an equal chance, basically, and turned those into frogs, and then watched them, tracked how survivable they were. And what you see in the details of the data is that the ones that actually survived better happened to be the ones that came from sperm of the males that the females were actually choosing in nature. Doesn't matter that she didn't know she was choosing correct genes. Fact is, she was doing it, and therefore it works. Now to 17. This is a human example now. Kind of a, well, it's a minor change in topics. This is an example of what we call heterozygote advantage. And the example specifically of heterozygote advantage we're seeing here has to do with sickle cell disease in humans. Sickle cell disease affects hemoglobin, which is a protein pigment in the blood, specifically in red blood cells. There are millions of individual hemoglobin molecules in just a single red blood cell, and there are billions and billions of red blood cells in the bloodstream, so there's a hell of a lot of these. But anyway, the job of hemoglobin as a circulatory system pigment is to carry oxygen and carbon dioxide. Now, think back to the genetics we already reviewed tonight. A gene, if it's a protein coding gene, which most genes are, will be transcribed into a specific kind of RNA called messenger RNA, right? The messenger RNA then gets translated into a specific polypeptide, the protein. That's true for hemoglobin as well, because hemoglobin is a protein. And you have the so-called wild type. For any given gene, you have individuals that are so-called wild type. The wild type simply means the individuals that you're most likely to encounter in a natural population, the phenotypes that they have. Doesn't necessarily mean it's the dominant or recessive, it's just the most abundant type in nature. And the wild type, when it comes to hemoglobin, is fully normal hemoglobin that is not, that cannot lead to sickle cell disease. All right, so the wild type gene for hemoglobin leads to a totally normal type of hemoglobin. But remember, we are diploid organisms. Therefore, we have two alleles for hemoglobin, right? One from each of our parents. And therefore, we can be homozygous dominant, which is the dominant, by the way, in this case, is the wild type, the normal hemoglobin. We can be homozygous recessive, or we can be heterozygous, because you have two versions of alleles here. Fully normal, wild type hemoglobin allele, and the defective, mutant type of allele, which leads to hemoglobin that is correct in all amino acids except one. This is an example of just one amino acid making a huge difference in the function of the protein. It makes it not very good at all at carrying oxygen and carbon dioxide. And therefore, if you have both of your alleles of this defective type, if you're homozygous recessive, in other words, homozygous mutant, then you have sickle cell disease. Just like you have cystic fibrosis if you're homozygous, right, before? Same thing here. And just like for cystic fibrosis, if you're heterozygous, you don't actually have the disorder. That's because you, being a heterozygous, having both alleles, you actually end up making both kinds of hemoglobin, normal and abnormal. But there's enough normal hemoglobin that you make for you to not actually have the symptoms of sickle cell disease, which is a bad disease. It leads to premature death. And therefore, a good likelihood that you're not going to survive to the point of passing your genes on, right? So, think about this. Natural selection selects against maladaptive alleles, right? And if natural selection is working, you would expect within some number of generations for the maladaptive mutant alleles to actually be selected out of the population. That would make sense, right? Eliminated by natural selection. It doesn't happen for sickle cell mutation. And that's because of heterozygote advantage. Okay, so If you are homozygous dominant, you are completely normal. You don't have any defective hemoglobin, and obviously you don't have sickle cell disease. That's good in terms of sickle cell disease to not have it, right? If you, the worst case obviously is to be homozygous recessive. You've got defective version from both parents, and therefore you have sickle cell disease. You might not live long enough to pass those genes on. But if you're heterozygous, that you do not have sickle cell disease, so you are going to survive in terms of that easily. But also, you're actually even better adapted than a fully normal homozygous dominant individual. And that's why we call it heterozygote advantage. The heterozygote is the best of the three possibilities. In certain conditions, specifically in conditions where malaria is really bad, a really bad problem. And that's because even though the mutant version of hemoglobin doesn't work very well for oxygen carrying, in a heterozygote, which is a normal person in terms of sickle cell disease because of the normal hemoglobin they make, the abnormal hemoglobin that they make actually makes them less susceptible to malarial infection. So it's less likely that they will contract malaria, which increases their survivability. And therefore, that's why this otherwise maladaptive gene gets carried on from generation to generation, because the heterozygotes are carrying it and doing better than anyone else. Okay? That's heterozygote advantage. And that this is why you find these alleles so prevalently in people of African origin, because the African continent is so affected by malaria. Malaria, it kills many, many people there. So that's why it's such a big deal there in those populations. Okay, let's go to 18 now. This is a different kind of selection operating, called frequency-dependent selection. This is a pretty interesting story also. The frequency, just like for allele frequencies or individual frequencies, that refers to a fraction of the population. But let me explain what's happening here in this particular example of frequency-dependent selection. You have two different species here, the orange fish and the gray fish. One of them is the predator, one of them is the prey species. Normally you would expect the predator to be the larger one, right? But in this case, the smaller one is the predator. They don't eat the bigger fish whole, obviously, because the prey fish is even bigger than the predator. But they take a chunk, they take a bite out of the side of the prey fish, the orange ones. All right, now, one unusual part of these predator fish, the gray ones, is that they are side-mouthed. Notice in the picture, the orange one, which is the prey, normal front-facing mouth, like you're used to seeing in fish. But the gray fish are side-mouthed, meaning the mouth is tilted to one side or the other. Now, both of these gray ones are members of the same species, the same population. So there are, within that one population, there are some individuals that are left-mouthed and some that are right-mouthed. And what determines whether you're left-mouthed or right-mouthed is which allele you have for the mouth-sidedness gene. Okay, so it's just natural heritable variation that determines your trait, whether right-mouthed or left-mouthed. Okay? All right, well, the reason that they're side-mouthed is because it makes it much easier to sneak up on the prey fish and get a bite out of it. If they were normal front-mouthed fish trying to get a bite out of the orange one that's bigger, they would basically have to T-bone it, right? And that would give the orange fish plenty of time to notice they're coming up to them. On the other hand, if you have a mouth face to the side, you can come up from the back and get a good bite without it ever seeing you. notice that to do that, you have to come up to the correct side, depending on which way your mouth is facing. If you come to the wrong side of the fish, you're biting nothing, right? So they have to attack. Any given kind of side mouth fish has to always attack from the same side. So this is why it's frequency dependent. The prey fish start learning this behavior. And in generations in which there is a high frequency of left-mouthed fish, which have to come up from the right side in order to be successful, then that means most of the attacks are from the right side, and the fish start noticing this, so they have behavior that makes it harder for these fish to, you know, they swim away from that direction. Well, that makes it harder for the majority of fish, but the minority of fish, which are the right, have the mouth facing the other direction, that's actually going to help them because they're going to be moving right toward those other ones. You see what I'm saying? And therefore, in that generation, the minority is going to be favored because they're going to get fed better. Does that make sense? Therefore, in the next generation, the genes that have gotten passed on are from the minority of the previous generation, which makes them the new majority in the next generation. So now most of them are coming from the other direction, and the fish start reversing, the prey fish start reversing their behavior, swimming the other direction to avoid the new majority, which makes it more favorable to the new minority again. And that's what you see by the red line going up and down. It just keeps going back and forth. In one generation, right mouth is favored. In the next generation, left mouth is favored, over and over. Frequency dependent. And I think that's the last slide. Oh no, you have one more slide. 19. This kind of illustrates a few important points, but you see a frog that is about to be eaten by a bat. And this brings up what I was talking about earlier when we talked about the frog example. The frog would be much more likely to survive and elude this predator, bat, if it were just to shut up and sit in place, right? Yes, that would make it likely to live longer, but it would have no chance of passing on its genes because no female is going to choose a silent frog. So the point here is that evolution is not a clean process. Natural selection is not a clean process. There are conflicting forces at play, right? There's a trade-off between having certain traits that will give you an advantage for reproduction and other traits, like being quiet, that will increase your survivability. And it's, you know, it's not just a nice, clean situation. That's one important point. Another is that, even though you don't really see it from this picture, is that natural selection never leads to a perfectly adapted population. Now, I said earlier multiple times that natural selection does reliably lead to an increase in adaptation. If you assume something, what do you have to assume for natural selection to keep increasing the adaptation? If the population is going to get better and better fit to the living conditions, what has to be true?
Environment has to stay the same.
Right. Those living conditions, or the environment, in other words, needs to stay the same. If that's true, natural selection is going to make it better and better. But no real environment ever stays the same, right? Things are changing. And therefore, what was favorable one generation might suddenly now be disfavorable. And this brings up another important point about natural selection. This is also why, well, this is why natural selection never gets to perfection, because it's always being disrupted by the changes in the environment. But also another important part of natural selection is that, and another reason why it doesn't lead to perfection, is that it doesn't start from scratch like design would. Natural selection only can operate on what's there already. right? It will, it's basically adding a Band-Aid every generation, because it you got something to start with. It's not like designing something where you start with nothing and you say, okay, these are the things I want, so I'm going to build this organism this way. That's not what natural selection does. It simply makes little changes to what was already there from the previous generation. And let me just make sure that this is the last slide. Yeah, it is.